listeners. Welcome to the next session.
An advice podcast for game masters who are seeking help with their next game session. I'm Adam Johns.
And I'm Alyssa Johns. Hey, we're back.
We're back. We're 100 plus episodes.
Yeah,
we've done that intro every single time.
You know, maybe not. There's a couple that we spiced it up a bit, I think.
Ooh, a little spicy.
Well, you know, new year, new podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Except if you know us, same podcast.
But new year.
Yeah.
Yeah, but same podcast.
We're coming at you with the same stuff that got you here before.
The same gold, rich gold podcast-y ichor.
Manna from heaven.
Manna. The same delicious manna from heaven.
Yum, this
podcast.
Chew it,
so
swallow,
glad that
eat
you,
it up. Here's your serving.
Here's your serving of our flan of a podcast.
Flambé.
Yeah.
All flambé.
Next session. let's jump in. I want to do some next session help. Do we have any of those?
No.
Oh. This is going to be a real short podcast.
Well, you know.
That was it.
Actually, we do. So we have been contacted by a new fan who has been binging all of our episodes.
Well, that's fun.
I know. And I
Speaking of our dessert podcast.
Yes. Just having a snack full. And I'm enjoying that they enjoy it. And so I've been getting a lot of correspondence from this person. And they go by John S., which I think is awesome.
Because it's like me. It's like John's.
Well, because like us.
Both of us, I guess.
Thank you.
You too.
Hey. Because I was going to say, because we're the Johnses, but
yeah,
he's John S. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so John S. Wrote a couple of messages, and I wanted to touch on a couple to mention on the podcast.
Okay.
So the first quick one was, I would love to know what items you have sitting at your table that you use. From dice to dry erase mats, et cetera, including tablets and apps.
Okay.
So what do you use?
Well, some of it's obviously going to depend on... Have we answered this before on the podcast?
Kind of.
Maybe we've touched on it a little
bit. Yeah, we've touched a little bit about some of the things that we use.
Okay.
Like, I like to use a laptop, and you are more notes guy.
Yeah. It depends on whether or not I'm running a game digitally or in person. But given the nature of the question, I'm going to assume in person is kind of the direction that we're going. I actually have, many years ago, Adam Davis and myself, when we were prepping for Game to Grow groups, and even before Game to Grow groups, we put together a kit of all the stuff we might need at a table. And we went to the Container Store and got one of those little plastic clamshells.
Oh, I love the Container Store. That's so great. I could live in the Container Store.
And it's got little separators so you can separate things into sections. And then we put together basically like what is all the stuff that we might need at the table, all the tools. And it contains pencils for all the players because everybody's going to forget pencils. It contains obviously some dice. And we actually would always provide dice for all of our players. Although if you're running an adult group, probably your players have their own dice that they want to have, but it really doesn't hurt to have a backup set of dice in case somebody forgot theirs or something, and you can have, hey, here's some backup dice for you.
Or if somebody wants to join in.
Yeah, or somebody like suddenly wants to join in, it really feels welcoming to be like, here's your set of dice that you have to jump right in and play with us. I would always put a set of Game Master dice because I like dice with different tactile sensations. I like metal dice or stone dice and things like that. It would contain 3x5 cards, really, really handy. They're great if you're going to do, X cards for your group, which is a style of sort of safety play, giving people tools to stop the game if they need to. You know, great for like yes no lists or no please lists if you do anything like that.
Or the rumor system.
Awesome for the rumor system, be able to hand out 3x5 cards to people so they can write down their rumors. Just really, really kind of handy little tools to have. We would also include, I loved having stuff like a fate dice. Fate dice are D6s that sometimes called fudge dice or fate dice. They're often used in the game of Fate, but they're D6s that don't have numbers on them. And instead they have two blank sides, two sides with minuses on them, and two sides with pluses on them. They're used in a lot of systems, so they also can be great ways to more or less give, you know, another option. They're essentially sort of a D3 kind of dice.
Yeah.
And it can be a great way to be like, here, you know what? I don't know what role we should use in this circumstance, so roll these instead. You know,
let's leave it up to the fate.
It spices things up a little bit. You know, a plus you succeed, a minus you don't, and a blank means I get to choose. or something like that. Like, that can be a fun way to spice things up as well. I also love to do, to just have a lot of funky dice. So I have, you know, a D100. I think in my kit, I have a dice that's all the letters of the alphabet.
Yeah, the alphabet dice.
Yeah, which is also great when you want to name something and you can be like, I don't know what to name this thing. Let's roll the alphabet dice. Put together some letters and that's going to be the name of this NPC that you're fighting against or whatever.
You also use a dry erase board sometimes, and you'll use like the map, the blank map that is just the grid that you use those vis-a-vis wet erase.
Yeah, I love a good dry erase board. I love having a grid map that I just can draw on so that I can add whatever I want in the circumstances. I'm a very improv-based DM, so my style often is me adjusting to whatever the needs are for the situation. I have plans and things like that, but my opportunity to suddenly like add a door to a back room or something like that is like too good to pass up. I love that stuff. So yeah, having that. I love a dry erase board for like a little handheld dry erase board, about the size of maybe a tablet or a laptop. That gives a lot of opportunity. I track my initiatives there, or I keep track of hit points, or I just put notes sometimes. Sometimes I will make, you know, draw out, you know, the room looks like this or the puzzle looks like this or something if I'm having a hard time describing it with just words. There's a lot of value to that kind of dry erase board that I keep along with me.
We got a lot to get through, so we gotta keep up the
pace.
I know.
I'm just thinking about all the everything. I want to explain all the pieces, but right?
John has another question, so we gotta.
All right.
I like to use on my laptop. I use Microsoft OneNote to take notes and to organize my game. That way, I also will tend to use Google Sheets.
Yeah.
Which is on Google Drive. It's really helpful. You have this like crazy note-taking tablet thing?
Yeah, I have and you can do this on an iPad or something, but I have a Super Note, which is like a note-taking writing, you know, handwriting e-ink thing. And that's great. You need a place to write down your stuff as a game master.
Mm-hmm.
So you suddenly make up an NPC, or you need to know what your plot is or whatever. Like, you should have a notebook somewhere that has that info.
And prior to that, you would always carry around these little Moleskine notebooks.
It's true. I love those as well. I like having places just to write down small things or small notes. And that could be scrap paper or sticky notes or anything. But it's nice if it's something consistent.
Yeah.
I like a DM screen. Not every game master uses a DM screen, but I like having that. I really don't use any of the info on the back of any of the sort of pre-made DM screens, although sometimes they can be very useful. That's just never been my preference. But I like having the screen up where I can put my notes, where I can put my dice behind it, where I can make rolls in secret if I need to. That all is really handy.
Yeah, and my DM screen is just my ludicrously large laptop.
Yeah.
Because it's like 15 inches, so it's just wonk, and then you can't see anything.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Okay, so I think we successfully answered that one. John S. also said, I wanted your opinion here. I've always wanted to create some sort of adventure where the players have all their armor, weapons, and gear removed. They're thrown in an underground prison, essentially a natural cavern, almost exactly like the first edition module A4 in the Dungeons of the Slave Lords. Two questions from this. How do you get the players into this dungeon that seems realistic and not just because the DM says so? And how would you run this?
Some interesting questions there. Okay, so I've never heard of In the Dungeons of the Slave Lords. I went and looked it up just to get a synopsis of it. It sounds like a interesting dungeon crawl.
Yeah, old school.
But the premise, it seems like, is exactly like you described, which is you're sort of dumped into a dungeon. You don't have any of your gear. Now you're here, you know, crawling your way through this dungeon without your gear.
MacGyver the poop out of this.
Yeah. Now, I have done plot lines many times where I take away the player's gear. Some things to keep in mind in doing that. Players don't like to have their gear taken away,
nope.
Especially if they're higher level and they've got a number of magic items, or they really, really rely on them, or they've grown attached to them. One of the very, very first things that you may have happen in that is players arguing about, well, I would never let go of this sword, or I would never, you know, I would have hidden my blankety blank away. Do I get to hide it? So you need to be prepared to mitigate those questions, as well as potentially reassure your players that they're going to get their gear back.
Now, I read this as you're starting your campaign without any gear,
which sounds great. I think in that case, you're not going to get a lot of that same pushback.
Right. So it's very important to make sure when your players are signing up to play that you explain to them ahead of time. Don't make it a surprise. Say, hey, we're going to roll characters and start without any gear. This is going to kind of be a fun, you're going to find gear as you go. I'm going to give you lots of opportunity to find gear or to make it yourself or whatever. But this is kind of what I have in my mind, in my vision. If you're up for it, I'm up for it. Let's do it. And make it exciting. Not a, you know, hey, by the way, I'm not going to have any gear. So, you know, let's see what happens.
Right. Or a like, is it okay if I take your gear away? No, or, you're like, you're excited for this plot.
You're going to start with no gear and you're going to like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're hardcore. You're excited for this. Like share your enthusiasm with them and be like, no, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a great time.
I want to see what happens. Let's discover it together.
Now, if you are starting off that way, that can be great. You can just say, don't set up your character with any gear. You're going to start with no gear. That's going to be part of the plot. If you are pushing them, and if you're going to do it that way, you can get your players into the dungeon by just description of this is where you start. You're all in a dungeon. That's, you know, whatever circumstances you had previously, doesn't matter. You are now in a dungeon. That's where you're starting.
I mean, we had an episode where we talked about why, like, if you start a campaign with all the players being prisoners, they're heading off to prison, remember, in that wagon?
Yeah.
And, like, what backstories you can say, you're in this dungeon. Give me a couple reasons why your character's here.
Yes. And that was exactly what I was going to say in this case, too, which is, as a game master, you have the power to state what reality is, but then give your players the chance to fill in backstory or their own preferences about how they got to that place. Mm-hmm. And this is a perfect example of that, where you can say, you are in this dungeon, you have your gear taken away, you've been arrested. You get to decide what you were arrested for. You can say, I was arrested because I was falsely accused, or I was arrested because I burned down the hat shop, or I was arrested because whatever the thing that got me into the situation.
I did it and I'm not sorry.
Right. And because I finally got revenge on the person that killed my parents. Like, okay, cool. Like, you get to create that backstory. But the end of that story is you are now arrested and in a dungeon with no gear. That has to be the end. So as a game master, you can offer to your players the opportunity to fill in some of the blanks, which will feel a lot less like a specifically the DM says so kind of MacGuffin, because they got a chance to have some input into what that circumstance is or what painted the situation. A lot of the times, game masters will do stuff where they're like, you're in a bar. Now the police charge in, they say, you're all under arrest, and then you're now on your way to the dungeon. And players don't like that because in that circumstance, they might go, well, I wouldn't have just let them arrest me. I would have fought back or anything. I would have run. Or, you know, what about my cloak of invisibility? Why didn't I use that? Like they don't like the fact that the moment where their characters normally get a chance to make a decision, they didn't get to make a decision. It's way easier to start at the end of that story, say, you have already been arrested, and then give them the opportunity to fill in what that journey looked like for their character. And now they do feel like they get to have input as to what their character's motivation or decisions may look like.
Absolutely. I agree. So then how would you go about running that? Now you've now set that up. They've given their backstory. You're in a cavern. What are some ways they would get out of this cavern?
So in the past, one of the stories that I absolutely love, where we did something very similar to this. Actually, we did. Funny enough, all the advice that I just gave that we didn't do that. We had the players go to sleep in a. They got invited to a town or something, and then the players went to sleep in a tavern. And then there was like a sleeping gas that basically put them all to sleep, and they woke up in a magical jail cell all together with none of their gear. In that case, we called it, I think it was Battle Arena.
Doesn't matter. Bimbo's Battle Arena.
It was Bimbo's Battle Arena. And one of the very first things that we did was we had them come face to face with the person who was running the Battle Arena, but they couldn't affect anything. There was a magical jail cell. It was an anti-magic jail cell, so they couldn't pass spells through it. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't impact this guy. And it gave an opportunity for this character to insult them and tell them like, oh, you're gonna be in this battle arena, and I'm gonna work you until you're dead, and basically make threats. And
this is very Thor: Love and Thunder.
It is very Thor: Love and Thunder. Although funny enough, we ran this before Thor: Love and Thunder ever came out. This is many years ago, but that opportunity presents them with, they get to see the bad guy, they get to kind of hate the bad guy, which is good for them to all align together, and they get some idea of like, what are the prison mechanics here? What is, you know, what can they do and what can they not do? And so that kind of setup was great for this kind of thing. If you're going to put them into a dungeon, giving them opportunities along the way to figure out who's running the dungeon, or why are they in this dungeon? Why them? Why have they been put into this dungeon as opposed to other people? Mm-hmm. Gives a lot of chance for you to set up more storyline along those ways. And it doesn't have to be right away, but you do want to have those. They're going to ask those questions early. So you want to have those breadcrumbs or answers pretty early on for the players. That could be done by, there's somebody in the jail cell with them who goes like, oh, your first time, huh? Let me tell you all about what this place is, or whatever.
Or you overhear some guards talking, or
right, or you break out of your initial jail cell and you question some guards.
Or maybe somebody has speak with animal.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk to the local rats.
Yeah, or gopher or something.
You know, the gopher in the jail cell.
The gopher that's you know, digging around in this underground jail cell, who was also arrested for digging. For gophering. He was bringing people coffee. So one of the very first things that you want to do is you want to be ready to answer the questions that the players may have, and then to set up what is the next step for them. When you're doing a kind of escape, if you've got a linear dungeon in mind, awesome. Then the next step is very clear. Go through the next door is the next step. But if there's very clearly like you need to escape this place, why? What is your thing? Is it just you're going to be imprisoned here for a long, long time and therefore you need to escape? Or is it like you're going to be put into an arena where you're going to be torn apart by crazy monsters because they are experimenting on you? Mm. And whatever the case may be, you want a little bit of pressure. Just being in jail sometimes is enough pressure for some players to go, no, I want my freedom. And sometimes they'll go, well, let's just wander around this jail and see if we can find some magic items or whatever. And being able to add a little bit of pressure, like, no, the longer you stay here, the more dangerous it is for you. You got to get out of here. Hmm. I think is a very important kind of setup to have for your players. I think that mostly answers it. I don't know if there's anything else.
Yeah, I think that's good.
I don't know what else I would say.
Give it a go.
The only other thing that I'll add in, I think your read on it, Alyssa, is probably right, which is it sounds like John S. is going to start the players at level one in this circumstance. But if you do start them at higher level and their equipment is taken away that they might care a lot about, making it clear that equipment likely is stored somewhere in this dungeon. You know, they probably took you away and they probably, you know, take off your equipment. You could have this again where like the person in the jail could answer that question, be like, where did they put our stuff? And he's like, well, they put it in a big storage room until they get a chance to sell it off for the highest bidder or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
or I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
And then later,
unless you give me a piece of gum or whatever.
Later you overhear him, hey, Frank, I didn't tell them that it was stored in the room next to them. Isn't that funny?
Isn't that funny? those prisoners. So being able to like have that answer then also readily available for your players, like, now you know you got to go find the room where they store your equipment so you can make your escape or whatever.
Cool.
John S., I hope you have a good time running the campaign. I've always had a blast stripping away the items from my players and seeing what they, like Alyssa said, what they can MacGyver together.
Oh, yeah.
Of like, you don't have any weapons, like... you go, all right, well, I'm going to break off this rotten piece of jail cell and use that. I'm gonna swing around this bench and use it as a shield.
I'm
going to
give everyone tetanus.
Yeah.
With my rusty
rusty shiv that I made.
Ha-ha, ha-ha.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate you finding our podcast. I'm glad that you're enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for being a part
friends.
Of it. Tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
Tell your group that you're DMing for.
Yeah. Unless they're going to listen to this episode and then you can't. See, that's the problem with our podcast.
That is a problem with
our
podcast.
You ask a question and then you want to be like, hey, my question got on this podcast, but you can't listen to it because they're going to tell me how to help.
Yeah.
You can listen to it in a week. How about that?
Yeah.
Tell them later.
After
it goes.
Yeah.
That'll be good. Then you can compare notes. What did A&A say? Oh, yeah. A&A said all this crappy
that
stuff.
That was a dumb answer. But we did the cool stuff.
I took that one little nugget of truth and made it awesome.
Yeah, which is what we expect all of our wonderful listeners to do.
Oh, yeah. You guys are way smarter than us.
Amazing game masters.
Hey, do we need to take a break?
Sure.
Let's take a break.
Okay.
And we're back.
Hey, we're back.
We back. Back from our long break.
Our long break.
It was so good. We have a couple Ask a GM questions. Ooh. I hope we have time for both of them.
Let's do it.
The first one is from Madman Poet.
Okay. Madman Poet.
Madman Poet.
That's pretty great. I like that.
Yes. Poet. Poet of the Madmen.
Yeah.
What would be a plausible relationship between a lich and their body? I know that the only thing keeping a lich in existence is their phylactery, but what is their relationship with their body? Like, do they need to have at least some sort of their body remaining to take physical form? Do they just need part of someone's body to use a physical form? Do they even need physical material to take physical form? How does that work?
Yeah, an interesting question. I actually don't know the rules for this.
Ooh, time for our super secret look it up.
Yeah. We should have like a look it up theme.
We're looking it up.
Looking
it up from the interwebs. Looking it up. Thanks for asking, but we're just going to Google it. Looking it up.
So we looked it up, and a lich does require a body to take some kind of physical form. However, their body is just a sort of lifeless husk that gets reformed if it's destroyed. So if you kill a lich or destroy its body or obliterate the body or any of that, it doesn't matter. The lich, the spirit of the lich goes away, the soul of the lich goes away, and the body just becomes a lifeless husk and then gets reformed next to their phylactery within a few days.
Yeah, ready to go.
Yeah.
A slain lich will generate a new body near their phylactery in a few days. That's the current edition.
Right.
Apparently in previous editions, the soul of the lich just possessed any convenient body near its phylactery instead.
Which sounds hilarious.
Yes. Either way, after their first death, post-lithification, the original body is kaput. I mean, the lich could have some kind of attachment to their original body, like fondness for it, and maybe the new generated bodies kind of look like the original. You could do that one.
Maybe they always like no matter what body they possess, they always sort of look like the lich anyway. Like the body just becomes,
yeah,
you know, looking like the lich. And it doesn't really matter. The body's just flesh and sinew that then gets like morphed into the lich's presentation.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with the lich's power. That's just a part of the process of phylactery or a part of the lich being a lich in some way.
If you are running a lich campaign, make sure you drop seeds of this kind of knowledge that is going to come about over time. Because I think that would like that way the players can like learn over time and then start putting the clues together that so and so might be a lich.
Now, here's an interesting question for you: what happens if you kill the lich? And of course, you know the lich itself, then the spirit goes away, but you still have the body there. Could you weakened at Bernie's the body and then have the body like show up next to the newly formed lich's body that's next to the phylactery, and then the old lich's body is like waving and chatting with the new lich? Could you do that? Like, does the old body just evaporate, or does it stick around and you could do stuff with it now that it's just an empty husk?
Great question. Okay, here's how I would rule it.
Yeah.
If the first body was not a generated body, if the first body was the original body,
oh,
I don't think it would disintegrate after the lich's soul is out of it. if the body was a generated body that just showed up next to the phylactery, I would think that that is only there because of the lich and the phylactery and all that magic.
Right.
Magic woo-woo. So as soon as the lich's soul goes away, I think it would like...
goes back to smoke or something.
Yeah, I think it would turn into... what is that at the end of the Marvel?
You get dusted.
Yeah, dusted.
Yeah.
I think it gets dusted.
Although I do like the idea that the lich can just make a big pile of their own bodies. like keep killing themselves, and then that body falls over, and then a couple of days they reform again, they got a whole new body, and then they have like a storage of these old bodies that are sitting around.
But then could they animate the dead
on their own body?
On their own bodies?
Oh yeah,
all of those bodies.
Yeah.
And they're all... you're fighting an army of liches, but you don't know which one is the real one, but based on decomposition. Yeah, it's not you.
No, not that one. That was real skeleton-y.
That one's real gross.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a funny concept.
All right, new campaign idea.
I think your read on it going back to dust or smoke or something is probably right. Although if I had players that had suggested the idea of puppeteering, doing a weekend of Bernie's on this lich and having him like show up in the town being like, I'm sorry everybody, I was missed. I really didn't mean to. I'm actually a good guy. Let me throw a party for everybody or whatever. I would like be down for
that
the hilariousness
be terrible,
of that.
Because then the town would be like, let their guard down, and then the real lich would show up again and be like, what the hell?
Yeah, but then the real lich would show up and he'd be like, what the hell? And then the fake lich would be next to him. And he'd be like, you're not the real lich. I'm the real lich.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And then the townspeople with their crossbows would be like, which one do we shoot?
This is a long, a lot of setup to get to this joke. This TV trope.
I love it.
Amazing.
I want to run that campaign.
I'm sorry, Madman Poet.
I just really want to do a Weekend at Bernie's campaign.
Apparently. You know, nothing's stopping you except don't kill anybody.
Yeah.
Love, Alyssa. All right, let's move on to our other Ask a GM question. This one's a bit more technical, and I think this one will require the internet.
Oh, okay.
It will for me, so let's see if you know
To the internet. Whoosh.
Whoosh. Stahlkönig? Stahlkönig.
Stahlkönig.
Koenig says, could a level 14 Eldritch Knight without the Warcaster feat, wearing a shield and holding a weapon, cast the Green Flame Blade cantrip that has a somatic component, make the cantrip's associated melee attack, and then make an Eldritch Knight level 7 war magic bonus action weapon attack? If yes, how, Adam, how? Because it seems to me that the Green Flame Blade somatic component requires the Eldritch Knight to drop their weapon to cast the cantrip. Am I wrong with that interpretation? If I'm not, doing so would leave the Eldritch Knight without a weapon in their hand for the cantrip's weapon attack. While they could use an item interaction to pick up the weapon for war magic bonus action weapon attack, where is the weapon for the cantrip's melee attack, Adam?
Woof. All right. So let's break this down. The question is...
I said it.
I know. I got to go back over it. It's a level 14 Eldritch Knight without the Warcaster feat, so they don't have Warcaster. They're wearing a shield and holding a weapon, and they want to cast the Green Flame Blade cantrip. So the Green Flame Blade cantrip is a casting time of one action. It has somatic and material components, and it says... you brandish the weapon used in the spell's casting to make a melee attack with it against one creature within 5 feet of you. On a hit, the target suffers a weapon attack's normal effects, and you can use green fire to leap from the target to a different creature of your choice you can see within 5 feet. The second creature takes fire damage equal to your spellcaster ability modifier. So let's be very clear that yes, just from that part at the start, if you had a shield and a weapon, you could cast Green Flame Blade because the somatic component of casting Green Flame Blade requires you to be brandishing a weapon as a part of it.
Okay.
So even though it requires a somatic component, I would rule that the weapon itself is part of the somatic, and you have to be holding that in order to to cast it.
Did you already say what a somatic component is?
That is a moving your hands. Somatic is some way in which you need to move your body or move your hands in order to cast the spell. Okay. Like a verbal component is the words you say, and a material component is whatever materials you have.
Because the material gets used, but a somatic component is a woo-woo with my hands.
Right. And
it's more of a gesture.
Yeah. If you had a spell that said the material component is a really big tree branch, and you have to cast it, and it also has a somatic component, you wouldn't rule, hey, you're holding the really big tree branch with both hands, therefore you can't cast the somatic portion of the spell.
Gotcha.
So the assumption is the materials that you use in the spell casting are being held by your hands in most cases. Maybe they're placed on the ground or something like that if the spell specifies it. But they are not counted against you holding something in order to accomplish the somatic component. They are considered a part of the somatic part of the
casting
of the
spell. Kind of like Harry Potter holding a wand, Wingardium Leviosa, swish and flick.
Right, exactly. You don't assume that Harry Potter can't cast that spell
Because he's holding his wand. You have to put your wand down and swish and flick.
Right, when he needs the wand to actually cast the spell.
That makes sense.
So the same case here. You have to have the sword in order to cast the spell. By contrast, if you didn't have a sword, you couldn't cast this spell.
Right. You have to have it. There's no need to drop anything.
Right. Okay, so that's the first part. You're wearing a shield, holding a weapon, cast Green Flame Blade cantrip that has a somatic component. Done. You did that. You make the cantrip's associated melee attack, and then make an Eldritch Knight level 7 war magic bonus attack, weapon attack. Beginning at 7th level, as an Eldritch Knight, when you use your action to cast a cantrip, you can make one weapon attack as a bonus action. So you then make an Eldritch Knight level 7 war magic bonus attack as a weapon. Yes, because when you cast Green Flame Blade, you are actually not replacing your blade with a magical blade that appears in your hand. You are, in fact, enhancing the weapon that you already have with some green flame on it. So, yes, you absolutely can use the Green Flame Blade, which, as a part of its cantrip, has you make a melee weapon attack. And then also use your bonus action given to you by 7th level as a thing that when you use your action to cast a cantrip, which you did with Green Flame Blade, you then make one weapon attack as a bonus action, which you can now do because you still have a sword in your hand.
Gotcha.
So that, I think, is the breakdown of all that.
However, to cast Shield, they would need a free hand.
That is true. and you'd have to rule, if you wanted to get into the minutiae of some of that, you would have to rule, you know, when do you put the weapon away to cast other spells?
Right.
And when do you drop it, and when do you pick it up, et cetera, et cetera. It would be worthwhile to recommend to this player that they just get the Warcaster feat, which then solves all of that.
Yes.
But ultimately, yes, there are more complicated things. Like if you wanted to cast any ranged cantrip and then make a melee weapon attack afterwards, you'd still have to be able to draw your weapon in order to make your melee weapon attack.
Gotcha. Woo, that was a lot. But Adam broke it down step by step. I really hope, Stahl, that you were following along, because I wasn't. I mean, I was. I love you. Whew, that was a lot. But we did it.
Yeah.
Go
there you
team.
Go. There you go, Stahl.
Go Quitting. Team. Hey, let's talk about another spell.
Yeah, let's do that.
Maybe we can move on to our favorite segment. Use that spell.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Use that spell.
Oh, the first one of the new year.
First, use that spell.
100 more to go, Adam.
Oh, there we go.
Well, it depends on the episode, but you know.
You know.
Actually, I wonder if anyone has counted how many use that spells we've done.
I doubt it. Maybe you have.
I haven't, but I bet I could find out.
Yeah.
If I had the time. So I was going to, I was very proud of myself, and I thought we haven't done Z yet as one of our letters for the episode titles. And so I was going to do Zephyr Strike. And turns out Adam and I recorded us talking about Zephyr Strike, and then I looked it up, and we already talked about it in season 3.
I bet we talked about it really positively.
I bet we did, because we just went over it again, and it was really good.
Yeah.
So if you want to hear Zephyr Strike, go back to season 3, and you can listen to that one. But we're going to talk about the only other Z-named spell I could find, which is a classic.
Ooh.
Zone of Truth.
Zone of Truth. I love Zone of Truth.
Zone of Truth. Which is from the Player's Handbook, second level enchantment. It is a casting time of one action, a range of 60 feet. Components are V and S, which is somatic, right?
Yes.
Yay.
Somatic is the S.
Because we were just talking about that.
Yeah.
Duration, 10 minutes. It says, you create a magical zone that guards against deception in a 15-foot radius sphere centered on a point of your choice within range. Until the spell ends, a creature that enters the spell's area for the first time on a turn or starts its turn there must make a charisma saving throw. On a failed save, a creature can't speak a deliberate lie while in the radius. You know whether each creature succeeds or fails on its saving throw. An affected creature is aware of the spell and can thus avoid answering questions to which it would normally respond with a lie. Such creatures can be evasive in its answers as long as it remains within the boundaries of the truth.
I love it. What a great classic spell. I've had lots of players use this effectively to further along the plot. I've had players use it in surprising ways. I've used it in surprising ways.
We had a an episode we talked about the eye patch, the magic item eye patch, mm-hmm. where you can deceive Zone of Truth.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Which was pretty good.
I've also had, I think I used this in the Psychology in Seattle podcast when the players were going through customs.
Oh, nice.
There was a zone of truth that they had to allow to affect themselves so that they could then be asked questions about their purpose in the city.
That's good. It's a classic. I like to listen to the Adventure Zone and the Balance campaign. It's like the main spell of one of the characters.
Yeah,
it's just zones of truth all the time.
Zone of truth that. I like this spell. It has brought up some things that I've heard from other game masters. Challenges with how to run this spell, like they capture a henchman right at the beginning of a whole campaign that's supposed to have all these interesting plot twists, and then somebody casts Zone of Truth, and then they go, oh no, now my henchman's going to give away all the fun plot twists of everything that's going on. Or I've seen game masters really struggle with, like, you know, can I use Zone of Truth to like discern knowledge that's outside of my character's knowledge, like I know that it's not true, and therefore I know that, like, I go, where is the magic item in this city? Is the magic item in this city? And there's magic item in this city. Or whatever, as a way of like kind of circumventing discovery in the game in other ways. And most of the time my answer to that is the spell only works on things that you know to be true or not to be true. So if somebody doesn't have any knowledge of what you're asking them, then they can't, they can tell you whatever. They can't lie to you, but they also can't somehow reveal a truth that they don't know. So if you ask the henchman, you know, where did they store the magic item? If the henchman doesn't know, he can't tell you that. And you don't know whether or not, you only know that he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. He can just say, I don't know. I don't know that information. And you know that he's not lying. Mm-hmm.
But they also they're not compelled to answer the question. They're just compelled not to lie.
It's true.
So they can be, like it says, it can be very evasive in its answers.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have had players attempt to cast this in a way where the person doesn't know that they have been affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will allow that from time to time. You know, I'll make them succeed on a check or something like that if the circumstances of it are especially fun or they're especially interesting to that. But I make it clear that as soon as the person tries to lie and can't, they will realize that they're being affected by a spell. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times that's enough to kind of give me an out if I need to as the game master to say, oh, you've asked some questions that this person is trying to not tell you about, and they realize they're being affected. But I think it's a really fun spell. I think it moves the plot along. I think it is, because you can choose not to answer or to be evasive. It's not like a truth serum. You definitely can just be like, no, I'm not going to tell you that.
Oh, you're trying to find out where the map is.
Yeah. That's what I hear from you.
Yeah. Yes. Where is the map?
Yeah. That's a good question.
The map? Oh, it's about this big and this wide. It looks like this.
Yeah.
I have seen it with my own eyes.
I have seen. You're right. I have seen the map.
They just run out the clock.
Yep. right?
But it is 10 minutes.
This is a pretty long clock.
That's a long clock.
Yeah. Anyway, super fun spell.
Classic.
I like it. Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. All right. Hey, thanks everybody for listening to episode 101.
Episode 101. Thanks so much for being a part of this. Thanks so much for listening to, I just presume you've listened to all the other episodes. So congratulations to you.
you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Wow.
Remember that you can submit us questions and we will potentially answer those questions on air. And if we do answer them, we will send you a sticker.
Only if you give me your address, though. You got to give me your address because otherwise I don't know where to put
it. We will send you, you know, you don't have to give the address as a part of the question. It's just after you send us a question, we'll send you a message back that says, oh, we're answering your question on air.
Yeah.
Can we get your address?
If you want a sticker.
If you don't answer that question, then we can't send you the sticker. So, that's how things work. But you can send us a question through the website by going to nextsessionpodcast.com and submit a question there.
You can also find us on Facebook at The Next Session and on Instagram at Next Session Podcast. You can slide into our DMs. We don't mind.
Yeah,
you can ask a question there also.
Get in on those DMs for those questions.
Slide on over. Come on down.
Oh, ridiculous. All right. So I'm Adam Jones.
And I'm Alyssa Jones.
Tune in next time and we'll help you prep for your next session.
Goodbye.